From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the battle between the White House and the press over who controls the flow of information is the subject of a new PBS Frontline series called News War. We'll talk with the correspondent for the series, Lowell Bergman. Also, a tribute to a classic Beatles recording, we talk with two members of the Smithereens, Pat D'Anizio and Dennis Dykin. Their new CD, Meet the Smithereens, features their versions of each of the songs on Meet the Beatles, which D'Anizio calls the holy grail of Beatles albums. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The relationship between the White House and the press, and the battle between them over who controls the flow of information to the public, is investigated in a new PBS Frontline series called News War. It begins tomorrow night. Here's an excerpt featuring New York Times executive editor Bill Keller and President Bush.
We're at war with a bunch of people who want to hurt the United States of America. And for people to leak that program and for a newspaper to publish it does great harm to the United States of America.
It may seem odd to ordinary Americans that somebody like me has the power to defy the President of the United States.
If you want to figure out what the terrorists are doing, you try to follow their money. And that's exactly what we're doing. And the fact that a newspaper disclosed it makes it harder to win this war on terror.
But in fact, that's the way the inventors of the country set things up, because the alternative was to let the government be the final arbiter of its own flow of information.
The first two editions of News War are titled Secrets, Sources, and Spin. Hour one will be shown tomorrow night, hour two on February 20th. The third edition will examine how the pressure for profits has affected journalism, and the fourth edition will look at media around the world, including the growing influence of Arab media. My guest is the correspondent for this Frontline series, Lowell Bergman. He's also reported for the New York Times, ABC News, and 60 Minutes. He was the model for the 60 Minutes producer played by Al Pacino in the movie The Insider. Lowell Bergman, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your series about the press, you describe the Valerie Wilson case as the most significant clash in decades between the press and the federal government. What gives it that distinction?
It's the first time, first of all, that a significant federal Supreme Court decision called Brandsburg, which has to do with the rights of reporters or the lack thereof, rights of reporters before a federal grand jury, that it's been reaffirmed in such a way that it's now clear under federal law that reporters have to testify before a federal grand jury or be willing to go to jail.
So how do you think that this case has changed the rules on reporters' abilities to protect confidential sources?
Well, for nearly 35 years, there's been more or less a truce between the federal government and the news media on the issue of testimony and when we have to testify. You have to understand his background in that period. 49 states have either passed laws saying that reporters do have a privilege, or the courts in those states have ruled that there is some kind of privilege. We don't really have that privilege established in federal criminal cases, and that's avoided the kind of spectacle that you have seen in the Libby trial, reporters trooping into court to testify either for the prosecution or the defense. It means a significant change in our relationship when we talk with people and what we can guarantee to them in terms of the keeping confidences and being able to develop stories. This is going to have, and has already had, ramifications across the country.
In the Valerie Wilson case, there were confidentiality waivers that were handed out in which sources waived their right to confidentiality, thus theoretically releasing the journalist from that confidentiality and allowing the journalist to testify. Are these confidentiality waivers a development introduced by this case?
It's the kind of procedure that often happens in other federal criminal cases or other criminal cases as a way of investigating, let's say, corrupt white-collar criminals. And therefore, they are part of a corporation. So they waive their Fifth Amendment rights, and the company can then fire them and say or distance themselves. In this case, similarly, the way it was used was that if a White House official who got one of these waivers from Patrick Fitzgerald didn't sign it, he was in jeopardy of losing his security clearance and his job. And so, therefore, there's a certain degree of coercion in doing that. And it means that to the reporter, you cannot be absolutely sure that this was a freely given waiver. And that became an issue in this case. But I think even more surprising have been certain developments where journalists like Tim Russert actually spoke with the FBI when they're involved in this criminal investigation without any resistance whatsoever. And that's a troubling development, it seems to me. Very troubling.
Why?
Because we have spent the last 3.5 decades in practice and in court trying very hard to create a situation where journalists and reporters are not seen as an arm of law enforcement. There was a day when reporters, particularly they were known as police reporters, traveled with, talked with, and shared information, favors, and activities with law enforcement. That meant people who were not necessarily in favor in terms of what law enforcement was up to at that particular time couldn't really talk to a reporter freely. That was one of the reasons where the whole Brandsburg crisis happened in 1972. Even though the press lost the Brandsburg case because of the times, the Nixon administration, the Watergate, and what followed, there were many reforms as a result, and there was the institution of guidelines in the Justice Department that are still there. And until very recently, those guidelines restricted law enforcement agents of the federal government from even questioning reporters, much less subpoenaing them. Now the gates seem to be open.
Since you referred to the Brandsburg decision, and since that's created an important precedent for press cases today, let me ask you to go back and explain what that decision was.
The Brandsburg case decided that journalists do not have the right to refuse to testify before a federal grand jury. At the same time, it recognized that there were some privileges that should be accorded to the press, but at least in that particular case, which involved law enforcement wanting the reporters to provide information on the one case about the Black Panther Party and its activities and who was who, and a group of marijuana growers, actually they were manufacturing hash oil in Kentucky, that they had no right to refuse. The irony of the decision was that while it went against the press, the reporters involved were never forced to testify or hand over their notes, in part because of the atmosphere at the time and because reporters were seen increasingly because of Watergate, which came right after the Brandsburg decision, as operating in the public interest. What we've seen is the reinterpretation of the Brandsburg decision today by district courts, particularly the one in Washington in the Miller case, which says that you absolutely have no rights. In this case, the reporters are testifying. In fact, they're marching into court as we speak.
In the Lewis Libby trial, we've heard about several reporters testifying, including Tim Russert, Judith Miller, Matt Cooper. And it seems that, like, some of them at least have made deals with the prosecutor in advance about what they will and what they won't be willing to answer. What do you know anything about what those deals have been like?
Well, they're very complicated deals in where there was some kind of negotiation. In Russert's case, apparently there was no deal. He just talked. The bottom line is that when you talk to a reporter now, particularly in Washington in the press corps where there's this kind of cozy confidentiality, you cannot be sure that they aren't going to be a witness against you.
From keeping up with the Valerie Wilson leak grand jury investigation and from keeping up with the Lewis Libby trial, do you feel like you've learned anything about how the Bush administration deals with the press?
I think what's come out that is quite striking is the degree to which the vice president and his office reacted to the possibility that there was a dissenter out there who could question their WMD rationale, and the degree to which they wanted to blame everything, if you will, on the CIA. The CIA, which had given them a national intelligence estimate that backed up their rationale for invading Iraq. So some of the inside baseball between the White House and the CIA seems to be it's fascinating to a reporter, at least, who has covered the area for a long period of time. What I have learned in the course of doing this investigation, and which is explained to a certain extent in this second hour and more so on the website, is that a little over 30 years ago, Vice President Cheney, then Deputy Chief of Staff Dick Cheney to Chief of Staff Donald Rumsfeld in the Ford administration, was actually actively involved in looking for ways to prosecute the New York Times, and in this case, Seymour Hersh, for espionage to try and plug leaks. And here we have him 30-some-odd 5 years later, in a sense, being the master leaker and declassifying secrets or thinking he has the power to do that. That's one of the ironies of this whole situation, from my perspective.
What, how leaking has changed, how it's often the government who leaks now?
Well, the government's always leaked, but that we've gotten some insight into how both they try to plug leaks and leak at the same time. It's an interesting kabuki dance that the Bush administration in particular, I think, has been involved in because they've tried to so hard to control their message. And the result is when you do that, you get leakers.
Are there other ways that you feel the Bush administration has changed the rules in terms of how a White House interacts with the press?
I think their disdain for the press, which they exhibited early on. You may remember the Adam Clymer episode where there was an open mic and the president and vice president, he's a reporter for the New York Times at the time, now retired, and they refer to him in a way that I don't think I can repeat on public broadcasting these days due to their FCC regulations. But they had ample opportunity to retract the statement, to apologize for saying those words. We asked in an interview with Mark McKinnon, one of his campaign officials that we get on camera, why they didn't apologize, and he looked straight in the camera and said, "What's there to apologize about?" So it's this attitude of the press is their enemy, or at least the so-called mainstream media is their enemy. Fox isn't their enemy. Certain partisan broadcasters in particular are not their enemy. And there's a repeat here in many ways. In our interviews with Pat Buchanan, who was in the Nixon administration and heavily involved in their communications policy, it's a policy that he started, which is to get around the so-called mainstream media and go to the local media, which is less likely to question them, go to more sympathetic venues. The Bush administration has done that in spades, and that's new. That combined with reversing policies over the previous Clinton administration to relax classification rules, reversing policies to open up more documents and be more transparent as a government. That has created a lot of tension between the news media and the administration that hadn't been there before.
Yeah, picking up on what you were saying, your documentary mentions that when Janet Reno was the Attorney General under President Clinton in 1993, she advised the attorneys working for her that when information was sought, it should be made available to the press unless there was some governmental reason to keep it secret. But John Ashcroft, when he became President Bush's Attorney General, revoked that policy. What did he put in its place?
Well, it was a policy to fight every request for information, to fight requests to broaden the Freedom of Information Act and to make more information available. And also on a national security level, the Clinton administration had begun to take what many in the media would say was a more rational view about the classification of information, that is, the stamping of it as top secret. That was also reversed. So there's a huge amount of material in the government, often newspaper clippings, that are stamped classified. And so that attitude towards openness obviously is going to create a problem with people in the media who want to get the story out. They are becoming more protective. We're always in the business of trying to learn more, and that's always an adversarial struggle. But in this particular case, in this particular administration, it's become particularly severe.
My guest is Lowell Bergman. He's the correspondent for the PBS Frontline series News War, which begins tomorrow night. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Lowell Bergman, and he is the correspondent for a four-part PBS Frontline series called News War, Secrets, Spin, and the Future of the News. And the series premieres Tuesday night on public television. One of the things you look at in the first couple of episodes is how the Bush administration has tried to stop information from being published. And you describe meetings that the Bush administration has had with the Washington Post and with the New York Times, trying to convince those papers not to go with stories. In the Washington Post case, it was a Dana Priest story about secret CIA detention centers. In the New York Times case, it was a story about the secret NSA wiretapping program. What have you learned about how the Bush administration tried to convince editors at the Post and the Times to not run those stories?
Well, in the case of the Post, Len Downey, the executive editor, says that he's not at liberty to discuss the conversations and even who he met with. In the case of the New York Times, because the White House had already made public the meeting and who was there and basically the purpose of it, Bill Keller, the executive editor, talked about it. And basically what he reports back is that they contended that any report on the program and its very existence would endanger the war on terror. Now, we're not talking about that the New York Times planned to report exactly how the program worked, what kind of phones, for example, exactly they could tap into and when, or emails, or how it was done. But the New York Times story focused, the first story focused primarily on the legality involved in it, as that is bypassing existing legislation that was supposed to monitor, and there's a secret court that's been set up to do that, all national security wiretapping or eavesdropping operations or break-ins. And so they claimed that when and if there was another attack, he'd hoped that the New York Times was sitting next to him in Congress when Congress wanted to know why this had happened. In other words, the idea is that you would have, as Bill Keller puts it, blood on your hands if you publish this story. You know that soon after that and what was called the Swift story that the New York Times published, there was discussion by the administration, by the Attorney General, by Republican members of Congress of trying to, in fact, prosecute the New York Times and reporters for espionage. So that's the kind of heat that's come down from the administration, and I can assure you that it doesn't make people feel very relaxed about publishing.
What does the Espionage Act have to say about what kind of news is forbidden to be published?
Well, maybe a little history here. We had a very famous case called the Pentagon Papers case, where the Nixon administration threatened the New York Times and then the Washington Post and what they said was, we're going to both get an injunction to stop you from publishing, and if you do publish, we're going to prosecute you under the Espionage Act. Well, the original Espionage Act was passed in 1917, and in fact, it's very difficult to prosecute the media under the provisions of that act. But there is, and as it turned out, the Nixon administration never did. But under a section of that act called the Signals Intelligence Act, it is a felony to publish information about the way in which U.S. national security agencies or entities communicate with each other, the use of encryption, and other things related to intercepting communications in the interests of the national security of the United States. So theoretically, you could be prosecuted under that act, and particularly when you're talking about something that the National Security Agency, which is this secret agency set up to intercept foreign communications, and that's what came down here, was the question of the National Security Agency intercepting conversations inside the United States or email traffic. Now, you could do that with the Espionage Act. No one ever has. And no one's really talked openly about trying to do it to the mass media since the Nixon administration until now.
So has the Bush administration actually threatened the New York Times or the Washington Post with prosecution under the Espionage Act?
There's just been discussion about the possibility. There have been people like Peter King, a representative from New York, a Republican representative, who has talked about it openly. There is a letter that was passed in the last Congress that was sent to the Justice Department requesting an investigation of the New York Times and others under the Espionage Act. So we don't know whether they are really seriously considering it or not, but we know they throw the idea around.
Now, the precedent sent by the Pentagon Papers is that the government can't use prior restraint to prevent a news media from publishing something, but that doesn't mean that they can't punish you after you've published it.
Right. The opinion itself by the Supreme Court said that the government cannot restrain you from publishing. However, if you think it's a violation of national security, they said go right ahead and prosecute him for espionage.
There are so many really difficult judgment calls that one has to make at any level of journalism. But when the White House pressures the media and says national security is at stake, and if you publish this and there's another terrorist attack, you will share the burden of the responsibility for it. That makes it, I think, a really tough call for any journalistic organization to make, because how can you tell if the White House is pressuring you to cover up something that would be embarrassing to them, or because this really is going to be a threat to our national security if it's published.
Well, I think Len Downey says in the film that the executive editor of the Washington Post, he is in possession of many secrets that have never been published by the Washington Post because they have shown restraint and have no desire, as Cy Hirsch would put it, to publish those kinds of secrets. In fact, what we're talking about is things like troop movements or the location of missiles or codes for an atom bomb to make it go off. The news media hasn't published anything like that, and I don't think that any of us in it think that those things are actually news. So I think the judgment is, what is the real information you are publishing? What is that they're calling secret? In the case of the NSA eavesdropping case, as Jim Risen, one of the authors, says, we were just publishing that it existed because the people of the United States should know that the government of the United States is eavesdropping and collecting your email without a warrant. And under the law, that's what they're supposed to do. But you make a decision. It's not our job. Our job is just simply to inform people of what's going on.
Lowell Bergman is the correspondent for the new PBS Frontline series, News War. It begins tomorrow night. Bergman will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Warner Home Video, presenting The Departed on DVD and high definition, including two documentaries on a two-disc set available Tuesday. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It won't be long,
coming up, the Smithereens do their version of the album Meet the Beatles. We'll talk with Dennis Dykin and Pat DiNizio about their CD, Meet the Smithereens. And we continue our conversation with Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman about his series, News War.
Here am I, sitting all on my own. It won't be long, yeah. It won't be long, yeah. It won't be long, yeah. Till I've been home to you. Since you left me, I'm so alone. But now you're coming up home. I'll be good like I know I should. Come down from my eyes. Every day I've done nothing but cry. It won't be long, yeah. It won't be long, yeah. It won't be long, yeah. Till I've been on to you. Since you left me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lowell Bergman. He's the correspondent for the new PBS Frontline series, News War, which begins tomorrow night. The first two editions examine the relationship between the government and the press and the battle over who controls the flow of information to the public. Both editions consider new pressures on journalists to reveal their sources, and not just in stories pertaining to national security. Two reporters risk jail if they don't reveal their sources on a story about baseball players and steroids. Here's one of them, Lance Williams.
I respect the court system, and I'll comply with their wishes in every way possible. But I am being asked to, not asked, told to betray not only sources, but ideals that I've held for 30 years as a reporter And I'm also being asked to give up my career because, don't kid yourself, if they bully me into betraying my sources, I can't work anymore.
Let's get back to our interview with Lowell Bergman, the correspondent for the Frontline series, News War. You know, one of the stories that you cover in the second episode of this series is the case of two journalists from the San Francisco Chronicle who revealed the story of baseball players, including Barry Bonds, and their use of steroids. And what happened was that they got access to grand jury testimony from baseball players. This led, as you point out in the program, this led to congressional investigation of steroid abuse. The reporters were praised by the president for this work that they did. And yet, a judge has asked the Justice Department to investigate the source of the leak of the grand jury testimony. The paper and the reporters are declining to say who the leak was. Can you talk a little bit about more about this case and its significance?
Well, first of all, the judge's orders and the case, by the way, we'll find out when the reporters are going to go to jail early in March. It doesn't look very good for them. One reason is that the Brandsburg decision, which we discussed earlier, got reaffirmed in the battle over Valerie Plame's identity, which resulted in the Miller case that reaffirmed Brandsburg. And so in that case, in San Francisco, the court cites the Miller case and the reaffirmation of Brandsburg, and that's a direct result of that struggle. You now see it happening in a case involving steroids, a case involving a situation where the President of the United States, as you said, praised the reporters for doing a public service, a situation where everybody understands that there are public health consequences to the whole steroid use amongst youth especially. And then you see the use of this discretion by the Justice Department. The judge can order, the FBI can investigate, but the Justice Department, which is an arm of the administration, has to decide whether or not to prosecute and push the case. And they decided to do that. And that's a change in policy. You see Mark Corallo in our documentary, who was the press person for Attorney General Ashcroft, saying that under Ashcroft, this would never have been approved because of these Justice Department guidelines that have been in place for over 30 years. But under Attorney General Gonzalez, it has been approved, and that's a big change.
Formerly, the standard for this kind of prosecution would have been violating national security, risking national security.
Or what they call exigent circumstances. If someone's life was in danger and I, as a reporter, refused to reveal the information to an FBI agent who was trying to stop, let's say, a bombing from happening, theoretically I could be subpoenaed to a grand jury and jailed until I talked. But that's not what steroid abuse has nothing to do with that in terms of making public information that may warn people that athletes are doing this and it's providing at least a bad public example. There's nothing of exigent circumstances, as Mr. Corallo points out. Now, the Justice Department is claiming that, quote, this was all reviewed through the normal procedures, and I assume it was. And it has to be approved by the Attorney General, and apparently it was.
So what's at stake for the two reporters who are risking jail, and what's at stake for journalism in general with this case?
What's at stake for the reporters is going to jail for the length of the grand jury, which can be 18 months, and the grand jury can also be extended, could be another 9 months, could be another 18 months beyond that, and then they could be prosecuted for criminal contempt, and that's a whole other potential world of jeopardy. But let's give you an example of the effect already. In Cleveland, Ohio, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a major metropolitan newspaper that is not making a lot of money these days, the editor announced in the wake of the Miller case that they would not publish a series that they had prepared on a federal investigation of corruption in Cleveland, Ohio, because they feared they would be subpoenaed before a federal grand jury that would want to know their sources. And the cost of that, just the legal cost of that, from what they saw, aside from other costs, was too great for this paper that is not making much money these days to bear. Therefore, we won't publish. One of the most difficult things to understand in all of this is that the evidence of what you don't learn is hard to prove or demonstrate. How many stories haven't been published? How many sources haven't stepped forward to report some information for fear that they'll be subpoenaed if they tell a reporter and the reporter will have to testify against them? the example that's being set is to keep your mouth shut if you know that something has gone wrong.
Now, one of the things that you report on in this series on the press is what it means when the Justice Department is called on to open a leak investigation. They have to file a report consisting of 11 questions. Would you describe what these 11 questions are and what the purpose is?
Well, as it was explained to us, there are these 11 questions, which you'll see on the air and will be on the website. And they're sent to an agency like the CIA that's a complaining victim. And one of the questions, as it's pointed out to us, is, was the classified leak true? And the reason is that apparently they can't prosecute somebody for leaking information that's not true. So therefore, when you hear that there is a national security leak investigation going on of a particular story, those of you out in the audience, it's a fact-checking thing that the FBI does for you. It means the story's true.
That's kind of paradoxical, isn't it? It's exactly the information they're trying to keep secret.
Exactly, and that's because of that reason, as you learn in Hour 2, they sometimes don't do leak investigations for fear of letting, let's say, the Soviet Union in the old days or the terrorists today know that the story is true.
There's another case that you cover in your series where a journalist is, this time he's not risking jail, he's in jail, and in fact he's broken the record for the number of days a journalist has served for not turning over information. And tell us about this case.
Well, I think this case actually says a lot about the maturity of the internet and what may happen in the future. And by that, I mean internet journalism. Here you have a young man, Josh Wolf, who is a video blogger in the kind of new tradition of the internet, a kind of citizen journalist, as it's called. And he has his own website. And he's become close to people who are opposed to the globalization. And he covers the demonstrations from the demonstrator side when they demonstrate against something like the G8 summit. He did that. He did it in San Francisco. He posted some of the video on the web. He sold some to a local station. And the next thing he knows, he's got the FBI knocking on the door because someone attacked a police car. It turned out they broke a taillight and attempted, apparently feebly, to set it on fire. Because the police car was partially funded with federal money, the government alleges they have jurisdiction. He is subpoenaed to a federal grand jury to testify and present his full videotape. He refuses because he concludes that what they really want him to do is identify the people in the videotape, and he's now doing time in jail. There hasn't been, and he went to jail back last summer. So he recently set the record. The court describes him, by the way, as a journalist in their opinions, and they cite the Miller case again. The reaffirmation of Brandsburg and say he has no rights before a federal grand jury to refuse to testify. He's been in jail and broken the record for a journalist being in jail for contempt of court in the history of the United States. And he is going to be in jail until next summer.
Because that's when they're reexamining the case?
No, that's when the grand jury runs out.
Oh,
so
I see.
He might, but he might, they can re-up the grand jury and he'd be in for another. Sometimes they extend a grand jury for 9 months, as they did in the Judy Miller case. She was facing another 6 to 9 months in jail if she had not made a deal with the prosecutor when she came out after 85 days. But in the case of Mr. Wolf, he could be in for a longer period of time. Traditional news organizations have been reluctant, apparently, with the exception, I think, of a journalism fraternity, Sigma Delta Chi, to step forward and back him and put in amicus briefs. But what surprised me in some of the interviews with some of the gurus of the internet, of citizen journalism, is they didn't seem to be really aware of this. And one of the things that were willing to step forward to protect him or to support him, and I think one of the things that we'll see happening over the next few years is the people who begin to practice journalism on the internet are going to find themselves confronting many of these issues themselves. And we'll be in a new ballpark here of the cyberspace and the criminal law.
Well, Lowell Bergman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lowell Bergman is the correspondent for the PBS Frontline series News War. It begins tomorrow night. The Smithereens have covered a classic Beatles album. Coming up, meet the Smithereens. This is Fresh Air. With the four opening tracks, I Want to Hold Your Hand, I Saw Her Standing There, This Boy, and It Won't Be Long, the word classic doesn't begin to do justice to the Beatles' album Meet the Beatles, which was released in the U.S. in 1964. The band The Smithereens has released a song-by-song tribute to it, which they have called Meet the Smithereens. The Smithereens are a band from New Jersey that's been recording since the early 80s and has been very influenced by British invasion bands. Their best-known songs include Blood and Roses and A Girl Like You. My guests are the lead singer, Pat D'Anizio, and drummer, Dennis Dykin. Here's a track from Meet the Smithereens.
1, 2, 3, 4! Well, she was just 17. You know what I mean, and the way she looked was way beyond compare. How could I dance with another?
Smithereens from the new CD, Meet the Smithereens. Pat, Dennis, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to do a cover of the Beatles?
Well, Terry, we had been invited to perform at a Beatles convention, which was a first for us, and we were asked to perform an all-Beatles cover set. The set was received very, very warmly. There was a tremendous response, and the audience was also calling out for Smithereens compositions during the course of the Beatles set. So we realized there was some crossover, and we began to receive emails from fans suggesting that we might consider the idea of perhaps putting out a Smithereens Beatles cover album. And it was always sort of an unspoken agreement amongst everyone in the Smithereens that Meet the Beatles was probably our favorite record as a group.
So, Dennis, of all the Beatles albums that you could have done, what appealed to you about Meet the Beatles, which was the first Beatles album released in America?
For me, as a drummer, the chance to go into a studio and play the songs from Meet the Beatles was just like reliving my childhood, being a drummer going down to the basement every day after school and playing along with my favorite records. Meet the Beatles is my favorite Beatles album, and Ringo was a huge influence and inspiration to me as a player. And I really think that it's probably, I'll probably get some flack about this, but I think it's Ringo's best playing as a drummer, and I think it's the best combo playing that the Beatles did as a group.
I want to play another track from Meet the Smithereens, and this is a nice contrast to the one we opened with. It's This Boy, which has great harmonies in it. Do you want to say something about why you like this early Beatles song?
The music on Meet the Beatles is deceivingly, it sounds simple, and it sounds like pop music, which it is, but it's actually very sophisticated stuff, especially for guys who are just scratching age 21. The harmonies on This Boy are really something else, as we learned when we tried to pick them apart to perform on the record. There's a great sense of urgency and yearning to This Boy, but a great sense of energy and a beauty.
Well, why don't we hear this boy from the Smithereens' new CD, Meet the Smithereens, which is their cover of Meet the Beatles.
That boy took my love away. Though he'll regret it someday. This boy wants you back again. That boy isn't good for you. Though he may want you to, this boy wants you back again. Oh, if this boy would be happy just to love you, but that boy won't be happy.
That's the Smithereens from their cover of the Beatles album, Meet the Beatles, which was released in 1964. Do you remember when you first got your copy of Meet the Beatles?
Yeah. My parents couldn't afford to buy it for me, and my Aunt Mary had a little bit of money, and it was at Brooks Record Shop in Plainfield, New Jersey. She took me down there, and I remember really digging the cover a lot more than introducing the Beatles. I think I had my choice. So I chose between the two, but I also wanted the album that had I Want to Hold Your Hand on it. And I wore my copy out, you know. But I, you know, the very first time I heard the Beatles was one wintry morning. I guess it would have been January of 64. And I was brushing my teeth listening to WABC, that fine, legendary AM top 40 station out of New York, listening to a DJ named Herb Oscar Anderson, who was our morning guy. And he was making light of the fact that he was about to play a record by a group from England, of all places, called The Beatles, making fun of the name and brushing my teeth. And when I heard the opening chords of I Want to Hold Your Hand, I literally dropped my toothbrush. And it was a transcendent moment. You know, from then on, my life was totally different. It was though I was hearing some strange music out of the moon.
And how old were you?
I was 8 years old in third grade in 1963, but I was already playing guitar. I had been playing guitar for a year before the Beatles were actually heard of by any of us in the States, and, you know, kind of weaned on the music of the Four Seasons and Jan and Dean and songs like Rockin', Wild Weekend by the Rockin' Rebels, that sort of top 40 music that was prevalent at the time. But as I said before, within weeks, everybody was scrambling to buy guitars and take lessons.
And Dennis, do you remember when you first bought Meet the Beatles?
Yeah, I didn't get it till my birthday in 1965. So that was a year later, in February of 65. But all my cousins had it. The kid across the street had it. But I do remember getting the single, I Want to Hold Your Hand, in February, or it might have been January of 64, I went to the record store with my mom, and I was really hot on a single by Bobby Rydell called Forget Him. And I had to have that record. In late 63, I wanted Forget Him. And so, lo and behold, it's January 64, and the Beatles had come out in the meantime. And we had heard about them and on the radio, and everybody was talking about them, but I had not yet seen a photo of them. So I went to this record store in Passaic, New Jersey. And back then, I don't know if you remember, but they used to tape up the 45s, like the top 20 or the top 40. They would tape them up on the door, the glass on the door, on the entrance to the record stores back then. So you could see the records, especially the ones with the picture sleeves. And there it was, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I froze in my tracks. It's the black and white photo of them where Paul's holding the cigarette that was later airbrushed out in 1980, I think. And it's a somewhat unflattering black and white photo. They don't really quite look like themselves in that particular Diesel Hoffman shot for whatever reason. I don't know if it was the lighting or just that particular second that the photo was snapped. But anyway, I was just gobsmacked when I saw this photo of the Beatles.
My guests are Dennis Dykin and Pat Denizio of the Smithereens. Their new CD is called Meet the Smithereens. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend I am kissing the lips I am missing, and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you.
My guests are Pat Denizio and Dennis Dykin of the band The Smithereens. They've just released a cover of the Beatles album Meet the Beatles called Meet the Smithereens. Before we get back to the interview, let's hear the Smithereens' 1989 hit, A Girl Like You. Have been playing together for decades. When did you get together? Was it around 1980?
That's right. First gig was March of 1980.
And were you still in school then? In college?
No,
or?
we were old already. We weren't spring chickens at the time.
I was 24 and I think Dennis was 22. So yes, we were very young. We thought we were old. I mean, I thought I was too old, Terry, to go to CBGB's and put on a motorcycle jacket, you know. I had a lot of familiar responsibilities, running the family garbage business. You know,
would your father have a business that you ran?
Yeah, it was N.A. Denizio and Son Disposal, and you know, I got up every morning for many years from the time I was 14, almost till the time we went on the road for the first tour in support of our first album, Especially for You. I'd get up at 4. By 4:30, I'd be starting up the garbage trucks, and by 5, I'd be walking with my 60-gallon plastic barrel drum behind people's houses picking up their garbage. So I did that for many years. But in fact, a lot of the inspiration for songs, I remember completing Blood and Roses while on the back of a garbage truck, oddly enough.
How did the family feel about you giving up the business and becoming a full-time musician?
Well, we had a bit of a conflict. By that time, my mom and dad had split up. And, you know, we practiced in my dad's basement. He was very gracious to the band. We drank all his booze, practiced in his basement from 7 o'clock at night till midnight, every night for like 5 years. And he was very nice about it. But at a certain point, he said, "Son, I want you to come home." I was living in New York. He said, "I got to talk to you about something." I said, "What is it, Dad?" He said, "Just come home." And we sat down at the kitchen table. We had a bottle of scotch there. And he said, "I want you to quit this rock and roll thing." He goes, "People are starting to talk. You're a bum." He goes, "I don't want my son to become a bum." He goes, I want you to stop this. Come back on the truck with me. You'll have a steady income. You'll have a good job, good business. Get on with your life. And I said, I'm not doing it. And he said, you're going to come back on the truck. And I said, I can't do it. And it was the first time that my dad and I ever cried together. You know, it was very, very emotional. But 6 to 8 months later, my dad was sitting in the 10th row of Radio City Music Hall watching us open a show for the Pretenders. And we had an album on the charts. So, you know, anything can happen.
Well, Pat D'Anizio, Dennis Dykin, thanks so much to both of you for talking with us.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Pat D'Anizio and Dennis Dykin of The Smithereens. Their new CD is Meet the Smithereens.
Oh, yeah, tell you something.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
I want to hold your hand. Oh, please say to me, you'll let me be your man. And please say to me, you'll let me hold your hand. Now let me hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. And when I touch you, I feel happy.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. In stores and online at bn.com. From Roadside Attractions, presenting Amazing Grace, based on the true story and song behind the abolition of the British slave trade, opens February 23rd. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with cartoonists R. Crumb and Aileen Kaminsky Crumb about their work and their lives together. They each have new books. He's the father of underground comics, and she was among the first women to create autobiographical comics. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.